From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we'll tell you about the Dome's reimagined project and what updates are coming to the horticultural hub. Then, we'll meet a Milwaukeean who created and shaped a surfboard made entirely of eco-friendly materials.
At first, I would call myself staying busy. Then I would say that I was a maker. And about 7 years ago, I realized that I'm an artist. And I decided to apply that skill to shaping surfboards.
Plus, we'll find out how pull tabs ended up in so many Wisconsin bars.
It's a very satisfying feeling of pulling those strips, kind of unzip them, and you see if you won a prize.
All that's coming up on Lake Effect, but first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us. After years of wondering what will happen to the deteriorating Mitchell Park domes, the Milwaukee County Board of Supervisors committed $30 million to the Dome's Reimagined project. The project will include expanded classroom space, a cafe, and a nature learning center. The effort is being led by the Friends of the Domes group. Executive Director Krista Beal-Diefenbach takes WUWM's Susan Bentz on a tour of the domes to learn about the renovations ahead.
This is what we refer to as the transition dome, and it's because these plants that you're looking at here don't live here permanently. They're kind of in and out of this space as we put on new shows. This was original to the build, so from a historic perspective, this fourth dome needs to stay here and it needs to look similar to what it does right now. However, what does allow us the opportunity to think about how we could use this space differently. So this is what we are envisioning as an interactive children's garden. So we'll replace all the glass, replace the heating system, but it's actually from a structural perspective is in great shape. And we have a very small education center that we use for about 5 different purposes. We're frequently having to kick the public out of the education center because we have a field trip. And so this will give us a space that would be always open for families and children. So, you know, we're talking about having a play structure, an accessible play structure here in the center, and then along the walls having all different types of activities and programming that allow children to really dig into their love of nature.
Where does that design come from?
Yeah, so the Domes Reimagined plan is really a combination of many previous plans over the last several decades.
So distilling the best of the best.
Yes, that's exactly right. So we pulled out what really worked. You know, some of the plans, the challenge was that they were created by groups of individuals who didn't always know the insider information about, you know, the facility. So for example, in a previous plan, there was an idea that we could turn the show dome into a restaurant, which sounds amazing, except for it's not a conditioned space. And so, you know, with this is a similar space. It's not air conditioned, but it is heated. But we could turn it into this fun play activity, you know, for children and for families. And so, you know, it really was the picking the best ideas and then, you know, molding it into something that really achieves two really critical objectives. We want to enhance the visitor experience. We want to make this an amazing modern conservatory that really allows people to connect with nature. And then the second objective is to create enough revenue so we have a sustainable business model. Because right now our emissions does not cover our expenses, our operating expenses. So with this new plan, everything drives revenue that might be membership revenue, it might be admissions revenue, or concessions or retail sales, you know, all of that together creates that sustainable business model.
So will this, reimagining of this dome happen in that first phase?
Yes. So this, and even within the first phase, we would do the restoration in phases within that first phase. So the first phase of phase one is the show dome and the, what we call the Little Sprouts Dome. The name might change, but that's a shorthand for us as the new children's garden, as the Little Sprouts Dome. We would start here and we would continue to have the rest of the facility open to the public. Doing it in phases allows us to really maximize our financing structure, but also allows us to be able to have this open and enjoyed by the public while we're under construction.
Part of what we're trying to do is extend the stay. So we know that people come here and they're in and out in about an hour. And if you think about what you might be willing to pay for an activity that takes an hour, it's probably what we're charging currently for admissions. We never want to have our admissions fee be so high that we're not accessible for the community. But if we were to charge a little bit more, especially for our, out-of-town visitors, that would definitely help with that business model. So one of our plans is to turn this area here into a cafe. There's a garage basement area beneath us, and this would just be turned into an enclosed space and would have access to that Little Sprouts Dome, so you can come and get an espresso and let your children have fun while they're playing. And we know that we're frequently listed as one of the five most popular places to go if you have young children. Mm-hmm. And so this will just really make it that much better of an experience. So we'll go and take a look at where the new building will be as well. But before we do that, I'll just show you. So this is the expanded gift shop. We're going to take over the offices right next door. And that will give us 100% increase in the size of the gift shop. And then we're also going to move the bathrooms that are over there. We're going to relocate them to a space that I'll show you in just a moment. But that will really allow us to open up this space, which is one of those challenges that we need to address. People can't get in quickly during our busiest season, which is, of course, when it's cold out. During the holiday show, during the train show, we will oftentimes have a line that goes all the way to the Circle Drive. People who pull into, the Circle Drive and they see that line, then they decide to go someplace else where they're not going to have to wait in the cold to get in. So by opening that whole admissions area up and being able to get people in faster, that we know that that will, again, help us to drive admissions revenue. I think the piece that's most interesting to me is just the complexity of this project, which is why we got to the point where it was just too difficult to find our way out of the dynamic that we were in to a better future. And so with the historic designation, that allows us access to really significant funding in both federal and state tax credits. Yes, it does require us to bring the National Park Service along on this journey, which is a layer of complexity for sure. But in the end, it also, puts the domes where it ought to be. They recognize the importance of the domes. They actually had placed the domes on their list of most endangered historic places. And, they are incredibly supportive of us finding a path forward. And so, even though the historic designation does add a layer of complexity, it also comes with a tremendous amount of benefits. Part of that is that funding that I mentioned, but part of it is also that we get placed on this, historic register, and that will increase our tourism dollars in the city of Milwaukee and in the state of Wisconsin. Okay, we're gonna go down here because I'll show you where the new building's gonna be.
Okay. So again, all of this is some phase of phase one, right?
Yes.
And you're envisioning that being how many years?
So phase one could be done in 4 years. A lot of it is because the facility allows for these additions in a pretty simple way. We're not having to create a whole new foundation. Like right here is where the new bathrooms will be.
Okay.
And so we're gonna use part of the hallway there. So this becomes all front of house space, and we'll be able to have these ADA compliant restrooms, and but we're not having to, we just can add it right on here. Mm-hmm. And the restoration or the enhancement is a lot easier than it might be if we had to build on a whole new building elsewhere.
Sure.
With that said, we do have the plan to put a new building, which would become our nature learning center. We have such limited space when it comes to our educational programming. And what we would love to have happen is that every MPS student goes to the domes for a field trip, which would require us to have much more space than what we currently have. We have almost hit the constraints of the facility with our current school field trip numbers, which is about 5,500 students a year. We want us to be able to increase that by 300%. To do that, we need more space. And so our plan is to add this Nature Learning Center, which would be a two-story building. You'll see that the landscape kind of dips down.
The old sunken garden story.
It is, yes, it is where the sunken gardens used to be. The fact that the topography goes down in that way actually allows us to have a two-story building next to the domes. With the historic designation, they would typically not want you to have that tall of a building right next to your historic building. But because of our landscape, it allows us to do that pretty easily. We would have this beautiful event space, which we could rent for weddings and for fundraisers and all different types of programs. And then we'd also have this really unique education space that allows us to, you know, have school field trips in there, but also we'll have other components. So the building itself will have a what's called a water retention system at the top. And so it will collect rainwater and release it after a storm event, but release it in such a way that it doesn't overwhelm our sewage system. By doing that, though, it also gives us the opportunity to educate our school field trip participants about the importance of stopping water where it falls. Many people don't think about, like, why does stopping water where it falls, why does that matter? Well, it matters to us as homeowners because, you know, if you overwhelm the sewer system, you end up having, you know, flooded basements, but also impacts our water quality. So, you know, if runoff is going into Lake Michigan, which is our drinking water, that runoff has chemicals in it that we are having to remove from our drinking water to make it safe. And that's becoming more and more difficult. So being able to help educate the community about that is just something that we can easily do and bake right into this new building and this new Nature Learning Center. We'll also be have air sensors that will be able to monitor the air quality on the south side of Milwaukee. We are located in one of the most densely populated parts of the state. We actually are designated as a heat island, and that is because of the amount of hardscape or, you know,
pavement
and buildings and all of, yes, or, yeah. Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. The amount of hardscape that exists in this community makes it so that the air quality is very poor. We rank in the 90th percentile for all those harsh chemicals that you don't want to have in your air. Which leads to our community also ranking in the, you know, 90th percentile for the number of children who have asthma. And so, you know, that air quality on the south side of Milwaukee is really a challenge. But it's something that this new Domes Reimagined project can help address.
You know, you talked about how densely populated this is. You know, it's a rich, diverse neighborhood. And I know Supervisor
Martinez
has been very adamant that this needs to be the people's place, right?
Right, absolutely. So this entire project really has been designed in partnership with many different entities, including our nearest neighbors. So we have quite a few neighbors who are on the Domes Reimagined Task Force. There's a friends group for Mitchell Park that Supervisor Martinez was really instrumental in creating. We've also done presentations to that group and many different community meetings where we've talked about the plans. It's important to note that right now we have architectural renderings, and sometimes to the public that can feel like it's done. But those aren't blueprints. This is the idea and the direction that we're going to head. But now we have this opportunity to go back to the community in a very systematic way and get their feedback and make sure that this is a project that is thoughtful of all of our stakeholders. Of course, the Domes is not just a Southside facility. However, it's an important, vital asset on the south side of Milwaukee. And so we want to make sure that that continues.
Krista Beal-Diefenbach is the executive director of the Friends of the Domes. That group is leading the effort to reimagine the domes. She led WUWM environmental reporter Susan Bentz on tour. The domes are a great place to celebrate nature and explore distant biomes. But for Juanita Ramos, there's much more than that. They're a sanctuary and a place to heal. Ramos is a survivor of domestic violence. For years, she endured emotional, financial, and physical abuse at the hands of her husband. One day, it all became too much. She leapt out of a second-story window in an attempt to escape. Ramos survived the fall with serious injuries to her foot. She found support and left her husband. And in the months of recovery that followed, she went to the domes daily. Years later, Ramos is an advocate and leader for other victims of abuse. She shares her story of nature and healing with Lena Tran.
When Juanita Ramos walks into the tropical dome, her face lights up. This, she says, might be her favorite dome of the three. It reminds her of her childhood home in Puerto Rico. The heat and humidity are familiar. The colors are a celebration, vibrant pinks and purples, and the plants are dramatic. Palms the size of coffee tables, moss and ferns and vines everywhere. The room hums with life. We see a corpse flower when we walk in. It's the size of a toddler. It hasn't bloomed yet, so its petals are snug around its core like a buttoned-up collar.
Okay, so look at that, see? Something happens to you, like it just happened to me right now. And then look at this. Look at this corpse flower. I just, so unique. Wow. This tree here, we used to have about three in the back here.
In your childhood home?
Yeah.
What is it?
It's, I don't know how they call it in English, but it's guanabana. It's a, like a white pulp inside, and you take all those, the skin out. And it has little seeds, black seeds. And the taste of the guanabana is like, it's not too sweet, not, I mean, it's just perfect. And I can taste it just by looking at the tree. I call these rainbows because they got so many colors. To me, it reminds me of fall. They're so intricate. And if you notice, not all the leaves are the same shape or length, they all have something different. And to me, that makes it so special. So every plant has a, you can create a story out of it, out of every plant, out of every flower. And it really does something to you. Your mind really goes away from everything that's really bothering you. And you just concentrate and meditate, and you can inspire you to talk to your, you know, to your God. You believe.
More than a decade ago, Juanita would find solace here, doing this very thing. Because of her injured foot, she couldn't go far from home. But she could actually see the domes from her old house. She pointed the house out to me before we walked in together. A brown roof from her past, across the busy street.
I will come down the stairs because I was living on the second floor. I would sit and come down, not using my legs, but my bottom. Until I got to the bottom of the stairs, then I would just kind of do something funny to grab the wheelchair. And it was painful. But it was worth it because I was coming over here and it made a whole difference in my life. And I did that for probably 7 months.
She said she would come and talk to the plants. And it's kind of like they would talk back and say, it's going to be okay. Things won't always be like this.
They were my friends at that time. If you talk to a human being, they'll say, well, if I was you, I would have done this, I would have done that. But if you talk to a plant, they just listen. They don't judge you. They don't tell you well, next time you better, you'll know better. Nothing. It was just, okay, here I am, you know. And so that's what I experienced. It was like I had to come every day and sit here and cry and talk to the plants and just sit down and meditate. And I don't know if you've been in there, but there, when they have different flowers, it's like the scent of the flowers. It's like you can just close your eyes, relax, and smell all of that. And it does something to you. It does something to your brain. Because when you go through trauma, your head is like pitch dark. It just, you don't, it's like you lose that sense of understanding yourself.
Juanita would bring her Bible to the domes. She lost herself in prayer. In the heat of the desert, the colors of the flowers, the heady scent of the rainforest. The plants she saw were beautiful, strong, thriving, things she wanted to be herself. She felt like she was in her own personal Eden.
Was your faith ever challenged in that dark time, or did it feel like you always had that?
You know what? I always knew that there's chaos around us, no matter what. And sooner or later, in a big or small degree, some of us are going to experience something in life that we don't, never wanted to, you know, experience. And so, what do you do when something like that happens? It's power and choice, right? So you either sit down, get mad, angry, you blame everybody, including God, or you said, okay, I'm gonna learn something out of this. And what I learned out of it, I'm gonna share it with somebody and maybe help somebody, not heal because I don't have the power, but in the sense of healing, in the sense of having someone who will listen to you and would not judge you. And I grew up in Puerto Rico, and they have a lot of the same plants that I grew up climbing on trees. Can you imagine you going through a lot, and then all of a sudden you remember, oh, I remember when I used to climb on those mango trees and go up there. And so your mind starts moving, it starts going back, and things that you probably forgot, never talked about it, all of a sudden it comes alive because of what you're going through and what you experienced in the past. So the experience in the past and the one now connect, and somehow a healing process starts.
It took you back to that time before these terrible things happened to you,
mm-hmm.
and to the person that you were
mm-hmm.
before then.
Exactly. And guess what the message was?
What?
It's going to be better. It can be the same or even better. And yes, it is. It got better to the point that my backyard is full of flowers.
Even now, Juanita says, the body has a way of remembering things that you don't want to remember. When that happens, she comes back here or heads into her garden in the backyard. There's birds, butterflies, roses, lavender. She can spend hours there. Juanita sees messages everywhere in nature, signs of God's love and design. She tells me about this time that she was in Florida a few years ago.
And there was a tree that fell because of Maria, the Hurricane Maria, but a few of the roots were in the ground. And the tree was the base for other plants to grow. And sort of remind me of me. And so I started to write about, sometimes we fall, but falling doesn't mean that you just die. You can nurture others around you. Like this tree, it had like about 10 different plants. you know those spider plants? There were so many on it. And animals like, you know, in Florida, there's all kinds of little animals, and they will go in there. And I just wrote a whole thing. Durante la tormenta, María, al árbol caído solo le quedaban algunas raíces incrustadas en la tierra.
Debido a su estado. She wrote about God's faithfulness. She believes that every flower is Him telling her, I love you, I have a plan. Even when you're in the desert, you are greater than your pain. And although you're in pain, you can help someone else heal. She wrote, even when you fall, you can help others get up. For WUWM, I'm Lena Tran.
That was Lena Tran and Juanita Ramos. Ramos eventually went to college for the first time and graduated magna cum laude. She had a second career as an early child educator. If you can't go to a bar without picking up some pull tabs, you'll want to stick around. In about 15 minutes, we'll learn about the history of pull tabs and what makes them so unique. But first, we'll meet a local surfer who created a board made of entirely eco-friendly materials. We'll tell you about the process and the conversations they hope it can start next on Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. If you've driven along the shores of Lake Michigan this winter, you may have come across some hardy surfers enjoying peak season for freshwater surfing. One local surfer, Ken Cole, took his passion for surfing beyond getting out on the water. He's created the world's first leaf-based surfboard to encompass what he believes is the art, soul, and sustainable future of surfing. Cole shaped his board with coffee bags, palm leaves, and plant-based resin. This board has been 6 years in the making, following a lot of trial and error and help from his community. Cole is featured in this month's issue of Milwaukee Magazine, and to share more about all the efforts that went into the eco-friendly surfboard, Ken Cole joins me now. He begins by explaining what motivated him to go from just a surfer to shaping his own boards.
At first, I would call myself staying busy, then I would say that I was a maker, and about 7 years ago, I realized that I'm an artist, and I decided to apply that skill to shaping surfboards. So it was a chance for me to really explore my passion for art, but also my passion for surfing, too. And when you look at most surfboards, they're basically, in essence, a shaped slab of foam with a fin on it and some decals and stickers. And boards are, trust me, I love all surfboards, they're great. But my goal was to make boards that capture the beauty of surfing. So I think back to like back in the day when you would see a radio or a television or even a car, like form and function were married and they were works of art. Yeah, exactly, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So every board that I shaped really kind of stood out to the point of a lot of folks would say this shouldn't be in the water. This should be on, this should be in my den or in a museum or something, which I took great pride in. But the goal was to literally make boards that were beautiful and that captured the essence of surfing. And they all are meant to be surfed.
Can you explain the typical traditional process and the materials involved in shaping surfboards? And then how your process differed, and was that a tenet for you from the start?
Yeah, so the typical process, if you want to really go back, is there's a famous photograph among surfers, let's say, and it's of a Hawaiian individual standing in front of Diamond Head, which is a mile or so in the background, and he's holding what's called a paipo, which is a 4-foot surfboard. It looks like a boogie board, and that's made of koa. So if you go back to its origins, surfing was made not by surfers in SoCal or back in Australia, but rather Hawaiians, indigenous peoples, and also Africa as well. And it was made from natural materials. So the way I look at it is that paipo, that mini surfboard, is somewhere in Hawaii now. It's gone full circle. So surfing evolved, and I think in the 50s or 60s, after hollow wooden surfboards and traditional surfboards, foam made its presence
known. Foam reigned.
Yeah, foam. Yeah. And foam, honestly, is an amazing thing to work with. It's fantastic. Every board I made, except for this one we'll talk about later, is made out of expanded polystyrene, which is made out of crude oil. And across the globe, foam is being banned for a host of reasons. One is that it's always going to be here with us. But also, two, it is reliant upon oil. So going back to what I said earlier is trying to find a way to have a board that captures the beauty of surfing while also respecting the water you surf in, it's impossible to accomplish that if you're riding on foam. And of the millions upon millions of boards that are out there, this is an estimate, 99.99%
sure
have a foam core. So my initial iteration was to see what I could do to depart from that a little bit, and it was very minor. So basically what I began to do was wrap the boards in jute or coffee bags. I would make my own fins. I would repurpose wood to have what's called a tail block, a nose block, and then use plant-based resin. And it got attention. It kind of got me wondering, well, what else could be done? But I found myself consistently running up against, oh, it's the foam, which is the core. Everything's built around that.
Yeah. And is it built around that because during the time it was just a material that worked best? Or is it because as surfers, you want a light board that moves well and that foam has always been the ticket?
Like I said, foam is fantastic. Mm-hmm. It is amazing. It's not quite feather light, but it's very light. And it's easy to shape, sculpt with. And once you get the resin and the glass and wrap it up, it is a joy to work with. But we shouldn't be working with it. There's other options.
Yeah. And do you think there's been a reluctance to shift to more eco-friendly boards or just that it hasn't been tried that much? Because surfers in general, I assume, care about keeping the waters they use clean and caring for the earth. Perhaps that's too broad, but,
I would like to think that surfers, if they were forced to make a choice, they would make a choice that supports the planet. That's my hope. I don't think the industry right now, though, is really pushing for that just yet because it is used for everything. Mm-hmm. It's almost like saying if someone said, well, you can run a car on steam tomorrow, it would be pretty difficult to change how we get from point A to point B. It'd be difficult to kind of break people's reliance upon oil and gas stations. The infrastructure is built for gas-powered vehicles. So it's an odd way of looking at it, but surfing's more reliant upon foam than we are on gas for our cars. So I just don't think that the industry right now is ready and willing to seriously consider what other options are out there.
So with your board, one key thing that kind of started your thought process, you came upon a plate made of palm leaves that's, disposable, biodegradable. How was this kind of the spark point for you?
Yeah, the story behind it, I think, is kind of interesting and humbling. A friend of mine, Tom, was having a, backyard birthday party for his daughter, and he distributes these leaves and dishware made of palm leaves. And I happened to be using one and pulled one out of the trash and began to think, and this is when I was beginning to make boards, what else could be done with this? So the first thing I made was a fin, and it was pretty sturdy. It's pretty light, but it wasn't very durable. It wasn't very strong. So toyed around with ways of prepping the leaf, working with the resin, positive pressure, all these things, and it was pretty durable. And that was kind of it, literally in someone's backyard, digging through trash at a party.
Inspiration strikes,
Yeah. And more than that, though, too, it has this aesthetic, which is natural, obviously, and no two leaves are the same, the grains that are on it. And when I prepped that and saw the outcome, I think that's what got things kind of going in that direction.
And you mentioned coffee bags, and that was part of your process from the beginning, right? Was the coffee bags and the board, and then the resin is kind of followed. You brought some examples here that I can touch and feel kind of the weight of the resin in the palm and the coffee bag. So these are kind of your three central ingredients, right?
Yeah, so the board itself, what I've done is I have replaced the entire foam core. And what you have is a surfboard that's made out of those three ingredients, the plant-based resin, jute, and then the palm leaf. So what's interesting is the jute serves the same purpose as fiberglass because there's a weave, right?
Yeah.
And that is something that goes on the outside of let's say, the palm leaf. And the end product is not just a surfboard that's made of this composite. The bait and switch in some respects is this board is made out of a composite material. And inside that surfboard is this truss structure that's made of multiple pieces of that. So it's one potential use of this composite that is comparable to plywood. So in essence, what we have here is an alternative to a reliance upon plywood. I have shared that it's the world's first surfboard made of leaves. And that's great. It gets attention. It's fun to talk about. But when you take a step back, the way that I look at it is not everybody surfs, but everybody sits. And this composite can be used to make a flat pack chair, let's say. It can be used to make a table. Yes, there's limits, but it can be used for that purpose. So it's kind of interesting how you go from this thought that happens in a guy's backyard to these iterations in a basement to MSOE engineers working with it to this finished product that kind of proves that if this complex structure that has to undergo quite a bit of pressure and, you know, the struggles of being in the water, what else could be done with that?
Right. I'm going to take a moment just to reintroduce you for our listeners. Sure. This is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski speaking with Ken Cole. He's made a surfboard for surfing on Lake Michigan out of eco-friendly materials. And Ken, you were just talking about all the steps from backyard trash inspiration to, you know, your first prototype and iteration. I want to get into a little bit more about how you got there and the community members that helped you. So how did other engineers and surfers and people at MSOE help you to fine-tune this process and these materials?
Yeah, it's I've been very fortunate. And it seems like much of it's related to surfing, too. So years ago, literally 6 years ago, a bunch of us were going up to Door County to surf. And I was riding with a professor. I didn't know he was a professor at the time. I just know him as Mike Sevier from MSOE. And we started just talking. And he shared a lot about his history working at SpaceX and his work now at MSOE. And he introduced me to Dr. Kevin Hart. And, you know, they're always creating, thinking of what next and trying to educate their students and broaden their horizon. And then reached out to a neighbor of mine, Saj, who works there as well. And just a confluence of great ideas and people being open-minded, we had a chance to meet with several folks there. And they offered up their services to meet with this guy.
As hobby maker.
This guy who had an idea.
Yeah.
And what was interesting, though, was it wasn't until I had that meeting with them that I kind of thought that this is not just some wacky thing, because I look at the work that they're doing, the number of students that they're, you know, teaching and educating, and just the success of the graduates. So I know that they're not going to take a lot of time out for something that's just some fly by night or some silly thing. And I think, too, that they saw the passion behind it. So over a lot of back and forth, we made some iterations. We tested it in their lab, looking at the best way to composite while also minimizing waste. And, you know, to their credit, they helped me refine that process. And they even gave me some news at the outset as far as the surfboard goes that was kind of disheartening, where they said, well, if you want to make this, it's going to end up weighing 100 pounds.
Mm, sure.
Which
doesn't help you.
Doesn't
in the water.
Help. Yeah. I mean, it would float, but who wants to carry a 100-pound board down to the beach, right? So what I learned, though, I'm not an engineer, but what I learned was that feedback was inspirational to kind of say, well, what else could be done? It eventually compelled me to look at another way, another truss structure that was actually brought forward by a colleague of mine, Ted, who helped me finish the board. And we ended up with one that is much more mobile, a heck of a lot lighter. And as you may have seen, it actually works.
Yeah, and with this board and testing it out, you're on prototype one. What next steps are exciting for you? Like, what are you continuously thinking about, working on? I'm sure your brain is running every time you take it out to see, like, oh, this was good today, and maybe this could change.
Yeah, and, you know, what's interesting is that's a question I get often.
Yeah.
And I can see why people ask it, because the natural reaction is for someone to say, well, what happens next? The other one that I've heard is, how do you make money at it? And, you know, my full-time gig is not doing this. This is my hobby. This is my stamp collecting. This is my, you know, we all have those, and this happens to be mine. I have a family and a job that means a lot to me, and I have to keep that focus. But I sometimes look at it as, I definitely want to make sure that this is presented to the world in a way that acknowledges the limitations of it, but at least sparks an interest in what else can be done. As I've shared with others, yes, I'm an artist, and I'm a psychologist as well, but if I'm able to come up with something that you could compare to plywood and all the uses that are there without having to contribute to deforestation, if I'm able to come up with a surfboard or a chair that I could sit in, or a box that I can stand on in my basement with the help of a handful of people, what happens if people who have a heck of a lot more resources and time than I do and a lot more training really explore other uses for palm leaves that are on the side of a freeway or in their backyard, or jute that gets tossed out at every, you know, coffee shop when they're done roasting, right? I think there's a lot of potential there. So my main hope is that this inspires people to look at what else could be done. I don't think you have to look far to recognize that the realities of climate change are unflinching and they're devastating. And my belief has been that people are relying on resources that are finite, and we're relying on what's been provided to us as solutions. And we're very, very close to recognizing that we can wait for engineers and scientists to come up with this. But some of them are funded by folks that aren't going to kind of push this kind of innovation. Or we can do it ourselves and hope that people catch on.
Well, Ken, I want to thank you so much for joining me today to share a bit more about this incredible board that you've built. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Ken Cole is the founder of Greenhouse Surfboards and inventor of the world's first leaf-based surfboard. You can find more information at WUWM.com, including the NPR piece featuring Cole by WUWM's Susan Bentz. Cole was also featured in this month's issue of Milwaukee Magazine in the article called New Wave. Did you know you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast? Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to download and listen on demand. Coming up, we'll learn about pull tabs, a staple of tavern culture here in Wisconsin. Keep listening to Lake Effect on WUWM. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. If you've ever been to a corner bar in Wisconsin, chances are you've seen a pull tab machine. They're a staple of tavern culture here in the state, a form of light gambling that brings together families and friends while they share a pitcher and complain about the Packers. T. Carullos explored the history and legality of pull tabs in an article for Milwaukee Magazine. He joins Lake Effect's Joy Powers to explore the culture of pull tabs.
If you had just moved to Milwaukee, you've never seen one of these machines before, how would you describe it?
A pull tab machine. They're found in a lot of bars across the state. And you put a buck into it, or $5, and then you get a game piece. And you flip it over, and there's these strips on the back. And it's a very satisfying feeling of pulling those strips, kind of unzip them, and you see if you won a prize. And it's not going to be a big prize, like you're not going to be able to retire from your day job, but they typically pay out a few dollars. The maximum you can win on one is $250. So is this kind of a fun thing that friends like to do at a bar? You get a bunch of pull tabs, you sit there unzipping them, seeing if anyone won, and a lot of times that money is just put into buying more beer or buying more pull tabs so you can keep playing.
Full disclosure, I would say about a month back, I had friends who were in town, one of whom is a Wisconsinite, loves pull tabs, and I did win. $1.
A dollar. I was going to say,
the pull tabs.
The most I've won is $2. So.
Yeah. which seems pretty standard. But one of the things that your article got into right away, which I have never really thought about before, is why are they legal? Like, for whatever reason, this had never occurred to me. But yeah, it is odd that they are legal.
Yeah, that's what started the whole story. My editor just wanted me to find out the answer to that question. And I found that the story behind it is pretty complicated, actually. It goes back to the late 90s. There was a guy named Walter Borer who was in the business of what they call coin-operated amusement machines. So he provided pinball and jukeboxes, stuff like that. And as sort of his retirement plan, he came up with Wisconsin Souvenir Mel Caps, which is the pull tab company. And he created this by very seriously studying Wisconsin Statute 100.16. there are exceptions to gambling in that. You can create a sweepstakes, right? So it is actually a sweepstakes. You can write to the company and they will mail you a game piece. But of course, most people prefer to play it at a bar while they're enjoying a beer. The other thing is, if you can attach your thing to something of value, and this is why if you've ever played like McDonald's Monopoly, that's legal, is because you get some French fries along with your game piece. So Walter thought about this, and his argument is that on the front of the pull tab, there's a circular design, and that design can be cut out and saved as a collectible POG. So that is sort of the loophole, if that's what you want to call it, is that you're actually paying for this collectible POG, not the game piece on the back, necessarily. So he had to go to court because in the late 90s, he was raided. They confiscated his pull tabs, and he was like, no, no, you don't, because I actually put a lot of thought into this. So he went to court, and they admitted that, you know, he was in the right and that what he was doing is legal. The Wisconsin Department of Revenue is a little skeptical of this.
Sure.
From talking to them. And they're like, come on, really a POG? But I don't know. I don't think it's a bad argument. I mean, I don't think there's a lot of POG collectors out there, but people collect vinyl and VHS tapes and I'm
people
sure there's
collect
POG collectors out
there
too.
Kinds of things. I used to and still have a small collection of potato chip bags.
Okay. See, yeah, people love to
weird
collect
things.
different things.
Now, it does seem like there was a bit of fancy footwork in order to make them legal using this kind of idea of, well, you know, the POG. That's really this. This is what people are buying. But as you say, it was fought out in courts. Pull tabs won, ostensibly. Now, are all pull tab machines today, are they all legal or?
No, I mean, according to what I found, Wisconsin Souvenir Mel Caps are the ones that are operating legally because they do follow those guidelines from Statute 100.16. So other pull tabs that you see out there are probably not legal because, you know, they don't have that collectible feature. You also have to keep records of certain winnings. You have to clearly state the odds on your game piece. There's a lot of like little details that you have to follow. And some of those other companies are just kind of making like knockoff pull tabs, I guess I would call them.
Hmm. It's interesting to think about them in that context just because they're such a Wisconsin thing. I think they're also popular in some other Midwestern states like Minnesota,
yeah,
for example.
Yeah.
But they are such a kind of cultural touch point. What do you think makes them so popular among people?
I mean, I think it works so well in Wisconsin just because the tavern culture here is so strong. It's most people spend some time hanging out in a bar, and this is something that kind of keep your hands busy, something social you can do with another person. There is that thrill, you know, even when I won $2, I was like, hey, I'm a winner. I won $2, you know. But like you say, they're very popular here. They're even more popular in our neighbor. Minnesota is the biggest state for pull tabs. And they do exist in other states. They usually have a different name that's more of like a localized thing. But yeah, it's a big part of the tavern culture here in general.
Well, T, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thanks for having me.
T. Krulos is a freelance writer based here in Milwaukee. He spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers about pull tabs in 2023. And that's Lake Effect for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Joy Powers, Sam Woods, and X-Grit Nunez join me in producing Lake Effect each week with help from Rob Larry and Graham Thomas. Becky Mortensen is our executive producer. Emily Files helps edit the show. We also heard from Mayon Silver and Susan Benz from the WUWM news team this week. Jason Reeve is our studio engineer. Michelle Maternowski is our digital manager. Valeria Navarro-Viegas is our digital editor. Trapper Shep wrote our theme music. If you've missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, you can download the Lake Effect podcast wherever you listen to your podcasts. Join us again on Monday for special coverage of the inauguration. Thank you so much for joining us today, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.